At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can you just tell me what you had for breakfast?
Me?
Yeah, so I can set my volume.
I thought my breath was bad or something. Oatmeal. You need more than that,
yeah,
right?
I do.
Bacon, eggs, ham and cheese omelet, some caviar.
Okay, we're good.
French toast.
Are we good to go? Are we rolling?
Hey, everyone. This week, we're taking a break from the series to bring you a bonus episode. We'll be back to regular programming next week. But right now, I want you to meet this guy. He's one of the first people I ever spoke to when I started working on Running Smoke.
Bones Force here. Freelance writer of books. Monthly columnist for magazines.
What do you write about?
All racing.
Bones is one of my favorite motorsports writers out there. A couple years ago, he helped a legendary race car driver write his autobiography. That driver's name was Gary Hot Shoe Ballou.
I had to wait a year and a half for him, and my boss kept saying, "Gary, come on, man. There's other people who could write this."
The voice you're hearing, well, that's the man himself, Gary Ballou.
I said, "No, there's not. There's only one can do it for me. That was around me and grew up around me and watched me race and knew my story and knew the players and knew the people and his bones." And nobody could have done a book like he did it. It's in my words. I mean, he cleaned it up a little bit here and there, but it's actually me talking, you know?
Gary won over 1,000 races, several championships, and earned himself a reputation as one of the toughest competitors in the field. But all of that was overshadowed in 1982, when FBI agents arrested Ballou and 60 others for running a marijuana smuggling operation. To be clear, Gary's story is quite different from Derek's story. But it does show how a racer's ambitions and his skill set can lead to success just as easily as it can lead to tragedy. I'll let Bones take it away.
Gary Ballou was a kid from just outside of Miami, Hialeah, Florida, who kind of grew up in the shadow down there of guys like Bobby and Donnie Allison and Red Farmer, drivers who gained spectacular fame in NASCAR. Gary was about a half a generation behind them. So he not only saw those guys compete at the local level, they're all from South Florida, but they recognized him as kind of a hungry young kid who was always sneaking into the pits, going to every race possible. He would hitchhike with those guys, bum rides to different tracks. He just had an enormous hunger, and he brought that hunger to his own racing once he got to be old enough, built cars, using the old tried and true junkyard method back then, and had a desire that he kind of burned with it. He saw these guys as being the best, and he wanted to be at that level. And worked his way from the South Florida tracks to dirt tracks in Pennsylvania and New Jersey that paid very well. He had won all the major short track races that he ran. He was definitely one of those guys that everybody acknowledged as being super talented. Very aggressive personality, fiery, you know, had a fight here and there, made an obscene gesture to an official here and there. He could be a polarizing figure, but as a guy who writes, you want to write about interesting people. And Gary was always, always interesting. There was always something happening around him.
So you saw Gary race back in the day?
I saw him race in the mid-70s for the first time at Syracuse, New York. There was a mile dirt track at the time. Once a year, they'd get together in October for this big race on the mile track. Gary won it 3 years in a row, 76, 7, and 8. And then every year we'd go to Florida for Daytona Speed Weeks, and he would compete nearby at New Smyrna Speedway. And he was dominant over there quite a bit. So, yeah, I saw him in a lot of different kinds of cars and saw him excel in every one of them. So, again, it just reinforced what I had always heard, which was he was just special.
There's four corners and two straightaways. It's pretty easy math. But you know what? If you get the four corners better than everybody else and then have a motor that runs down the straightaway, then it handles down the straightaway, then it really becomes fast. I never won a race by myself, but I've always had a lot of really, really, really good people believing in me that worked their ass off and worked as hard as they could and had their heart into it to win so we could all win together. And we won together.
What did you see in Gary's racing style that set him apart?
The first thing anybody notices about him is that he's super aggressive. You know, that you know, if a hole opens up, you go for it right now. If you can't go inside a guy to pass, which is probably the easiest way, just go around him. You know, just don't mess around too long. When you catch a guy, do something. And yet, a lot of guys who do that, they might win one night and then crash the next three nights. Gary, even though he had that raw aggressiveness, had a way of winning long races, and those things don't always go together. So you started to think that there was a real brain there, in addition to, you know, whatever he had naturally, whatever gifts he had, you know, balance, reflexes, eyesight, all the things that go into probably any driver. He also had that ability to plot out a race. You know, the other thing was the fact that he'd won, you know, in bulky, clumsy dirt track modifieds and sleek, fast, well-handling asphalt cars. You know, it's like no matter what he got into, he excelled. And then ended up moving back to Florida in the late 70s to sort of pursue his dream of NASCAR racing.
By the late 70s, Gary had managed to win just about every major race east of the Mississippi, in just about anything with four wheels and a motor. For a driver of his caliber, there was only one thing on his mind: the NASCAR Cup Series, the pinnacle of American motorsports. To pursue that dream, Gary decided to move back down to South Florida, where he knew some race team owners that could help him get behind the wheel of a cup car.
I mean, everybody remembers the show Miami Vice. I think that came out maybe in 85. But it was based on what all those people in Hollywood had seen for the last however many years. Gary got back down there in 78 or 79 in Miami. And, you know, kind of the way he put it is everywhere you looked, there were people that were driving cars that if you looked at them really quickly, you wouldn't think they would own. You know, a guy that you knew was maybe a Saturday night racer shouldn't be driving around in a Mercedes or a Ferrari. And then some of these guys were living in houses that you knew, based on whatever profession they were in, they probably shouldn't have been able to afford. And I think he got curious about that. And some of the people he started driving for were most definitely wrapped up in that end of life. I mean, I remember going to New Smyrna every February and seeing three or four guys every year, and they were all South Florida guys, where you knew there, it wasn't a rumor that they'd been involved in something like that. It was a well-known fact. You know, these guys had beautiful race cars and beautiful tow vehicles and gorgeous trailers, and you knew the money was coming from somewhere. There were no big sponsors on the side of the car. It was kind of just like an open wink, wink, kind of a secret that that's what they were into.
It made perfect sense that racers would feature prominently in the drug smuggling scene back in the day. The skill set that made you successful in the drug business would serve you well in racing, and vice versa.
I think what racers also have is that, you know, that willingness to risk things. You know, the best racers all have a high degree of being comfortable with risk. They're all decisive thinkers, as we said. A lot of them are good plan A, plan B, plan C type people, because in a race, you know, it's the old boxing thing. Everybody has a plan till you get hit in the nose. Well, in racing, everybody has a plan till they throw the green flag. So if plan A doesn't work, you go to plan B. You go to, you know, you're going to pass this guy on the outside and then he moves over, so you got to pass him on the bottom. You know, you're very reactive. And the way Gary says it, somebody told him, you know, you'd be perfect for this. You know, if you want to kind of just get a feel for what it's like, you can come on one of these trips and you can be what's called a counter. And the counter was, if you and your friends from South Florida were going to the Bahamas somewhere in a little cove or someplace, and you were meeting another group that was, in this case, Colombians, and they had a counter on their boat and you had a counter on your boat. And what the counter was the guy who, as they unloaded 37 bales or whatever it was, whatever the amount was, from their boat onto your boat, their counter agreed that they had unloaded 37, and you were the guy that counted and saw that, okay, we've got 37. And then, so, you know, he did it the first time. It went off without a hitch, you know, got home, made the kind of money that you wouldn't have made if you won every race for 2 or 3 months at the short track level. And I think once you do it and get away with it, no matter what it is in life, if you get away with something once, it's going to be easier the second time, I think. And it obviously was for him. And, you know, you go again, and then you go again. And I think he just sort of found himself deeper and deeper and deeper into it until there might come a point where you don't even think of yourself as being in it anymore. You are just in it.
Yeah, the rush was like winning the Daytona 500. You know what I mean? Like, wow. And the money was way better than racing, I can tell you that.
More after the break.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie. He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Run and Smoke from Campside Media.
By the early 1980s, the team owners Gary was working with in South Florida had managed to get him into a cup car. The equipment wasn't top-notch, so Gary wasn't leading laps or competing for the win, but he was making a mark nonetheless.
Did drug money contribute to him getting all the way to the Cup Series?
Yeah, I think on some level it did, because it financed his short track stuff. He was already unbelievably talented, but he was able to do, not just him, but I mean, he drove for some people who were involved in it too, so you were in better equipment than you'd ever been in. I think it made more people look at him, for sure.
In 1982, Gary Belew entered the Daytona 500, the highest profile event in the whole NASCAR season.
The Daytona 500, the great American race. From every corner of the country, for the 24th consecutive year, stock car racing's faithful returned last week to Daytona Beach. They partied, they soaked up the sun, had beer and barbecue. Last Sunday, the 500. Traditionally, a 10-car battle all day long, and a race that tells us a lot about who's going to run strong for the rest of the season. That left Cale Yarborough and Darrell Waltrip as the only real contenders, but Yarborough couldn't avoid a spinning Gary Belew. Cale made it to the pits, changed tires, and held on to finish second. Waltrip fell out with a blown engine. Avoiding the destruction to win it easily, Bobby Allison, though he ran out of gas on the cool-off lap and had to be pushed to victory lane.
Despite some mechanical troubles that day, Gary finished in 11th place. It would be the last time he would ever race at Daytona.
After that 1982 Daytona 500, 4 days later, 70 different people were sort of rounded up in the wee hours of the morning, all across Florida and a couple of more up in North Carolina. So there were 70 people in that ring indicted.
Two drivers will not see action at Richmond. They have some explaining to do to the FBI. In the pre-dawn darkness Thursday morning, federal agents arrested NASCAR driver Gary Belew, who finished 11th in last week's Daytona 500. The drivers and 68 other people were indicted on drug smuggling charges.
The organization would offload marijuana from motherships, bring it into this country, and then have it unloaded again and stored. It would be eventually turned over to owners or buyers of this marijuana. And the group handling the offloading and importation would receive a percentage of the marijuana as payment for their services.
During its 2.5-year investigation, the FBI received total cooperation from NASCAR in tracing the drug ring's efforts to use stock car racing as a front for its activities. Also arrested were a number of mechanics associated with those drivers, and $6 million in property was seized as well.
Gary was the most visible name on the bunch. I was living in Connecticut at the time, and I don't remember if it was in the Hartford paper or in one of the New York daily papers, but his picture was in there, big as life, you know, getting let out, and he was wearing a jacket. It was winter. Even in Florida, it was winter, and having a, you know, an FBI guy escort him along, you know, head down and the whole, it looked like a typical perp walk type photo, and it was kind of jarring at the time, even though it was kind of an open secret what a lot of those guys were doing. It was just like, oh my God, you know, this, you hate to say poor Gary, because it was a mistake that he made. You know, he made his own decisions and paid for it. But there was something I think that resonated in people that, you know, that maybe he was more of a shame to have that happen to than some guys were, because you kind of thought, and I still think it's that what might have been. In the next couple of weekends, guys that sort of knew him before and had enough respect for him that without saying this, they were kind of saying, you know, you really did screw up here, but, you know, you're our friend, you're our fellow competitor. Maybe let's not talk about it. You know, you don't have to say that. You just kind of know, let's not talk about it. But yeah, you are ostracized on some level because you're not going to get a Madison Avenue, you know, advertising executive making a sponsorship decision that goes in your favor if you've been indicted for drug smuggling. So on that level, yeah, he was ostracized. The sport kind of let him stay around. You know, NASCAR, I'm sure it was a hell of a thing for them to decide, what do you do with this guy? He was found guilty. You know, it had to be a heck of a line for them to walk and a heck of a fairly fast decision for them to make.
They have 98% rate of winning. They got all the money, got all the time. They make the rules. They say what they want to say, do what they want to do. That's the way the system is. You're not going to beat them. Like I said before, if your first clue is when they said United States of America versus Gary Ballou, that's your first clue right there. You think you're going to go against the United States government and beat them? You're an idiot.
But, you know, he fought it for a long time. They appealed, and he continued to race until 1986. So for 4 years, he was out and about, although, you know, you're in trial a lot of the time. He did manage to run and win some fairly big short track races in that time. He won the championship of a late model series called the All-Pro series, which was really big in the South. It was kind of a, maybe like the racing version of single-A baseball or something, you know, a respected minor league. He won the championship for that, went to the awards banquet in the beginning of 87, celebrated the championship, got up, got the trophy, got the pictures, got the prize money, the whole deal. And Monday morning, he had to turn himself in. So the cliche he always uses is, that's what it felt like to be champion for a day. You know, he had Sunday. And he did admit that they celebrated pretty hard. You know, you've got nothing to lose at that point. And Monday morning, he had to report to a federal facility. And I think the first one was Texas. And that was it. You know, you flew there on Sunday, reported on Monday, and began a series of a few years behind bars. And I'm sure that had to be an amazing come down for a guy who had been, you know, for a lot of his life had been kind of the toast of the party. And I mean, not necessarily parties, but, you know, you're the guy in Victory Lane. You're the guy that people want autographs from. You're the guy that people want to meet. You're the guy that car owners want to drive their equipment. You're the guy that rivals look to for inspiration as a driver and maybe for chassis setup, technology, wisdom, as a competitor. You know, he was always on top of his game that way too. So you go from being, you know, a guy who's been celebrated for most of your life to being just a number in a very, very, you know, bad place. Around 90, 91, 92, he reached a point where he realized, I think when he first came out, he thought, okay, I've paid my debts to society. I'll make it back. You know, I'll win all these major short track races. I'll show everybody that I am what I was before, and I'll get back to the cup level. But life had moved on. You know, you're no longer the hot young guy that he was at one time, and racing had changed to now where, you know, a young guy was no longer 30 or 32. Now the young guys were 19, 20, 21, 25. So, you know, if you were in your 40s, you were almost an old man at that point. It was going to be really exceptional if he got there. And yeah, he was exceptional talent-wise, but you've also got that giant albatross around your neck as having been a convicted drug smuggler. So there was no upside really for any major team hiring a guy like Gary. He was still incredibly talented, but there's a lot of incredibly talented race drivers out there. And he reached a point where he realized he wasn't going to make it anymore. He was living in Charlotte at this time when he was trying to rebuild his career and went to Florida. And as he puts it, kind of got talked into, well, why don't you just go on this one more run? You know, just you need a little money, you know, this will be good. And as he said, you do it once, you're sort of right back into it. He jokes about this, but he's also deadly serious when he says it. He said, I approached my smuggling like I approached my racing. He was prepared. He had contingency plans for everything. Well, he had backup fuel pumps and backup, you know, backups for backups. He was very well prepared if something went wrong in the middle of the night on the ocean, where otherwise you just sort of float around out there with a broken down boat waiting for somebody to discover you. And if somebody is the Coast Guard or the DEA, you know, you're going back to jail.
I made all my stuff as nice as I could, light as I could, clean as I could. And I worked hard. I tested it, trying different stuff and different motors and different people. That being said, I smuggle the same way with my boats. Because when you break down, you're in trouble. You can't throw that stuff over because it floats right with you.
So I think probably the people that were involved in that liked having him around because he was good from that standpoint. He knew what he was doing.
But all the preparations and concealed compartments in the world won't help if the DEA already has eyes on you before you even leave the dock. As soon as he picked up his load and started back towards land, he was surrounded by police. Gary Ballou spent the next 6 years in prison and was let out in 2010.
The shame that time is that he didn't learn from his mistake. You know, now your family's back into it again. Now you're back in prison. You know, so there's two levels of it. It was a shame for so many people who knew him to see him go through that the first time because you thought, you know, what a waste of talent, enormous talent. And I should say that the landscape had changed from a pop culture point of view. You know, Miami Vice wasn't cool in the 90s. You know what I mean? Nobody looked at it like a fun outlaw thing anymore. You know, by then, the whole drug thing, you know, everybody knew by then what toll drugs took on families and kids and crime in cities. You know, it was no longer something you could wink your way through.
Nowadays, Gary isn't driving anymore, but he's still in the racing world.
He does work with teams at different levels of the sport, including even like in the NASCAR Truck Series, you know, helping teams and mentoring drivers. He's got so much to offer. There's definitely a lot still in him, but you know, you're a guy that's 70 years old or whatever in a young man's game. You can be a mentor, but you know, the ugly truth of it is probably, you know, just simple math. Most of the young drivers that come up today don't remember who he was or what he was, you know, when he was winning races in the 70s and 80s. It's just a lot of those kids weren't born, you know, until the late 80s or the 90s. You know, he takes work as and when he can find it, and he's still really respected by certain guys in the sport, by almost everybody in the sport that's been around. There are people who held it against him for a long time, didn't want anything to do with him, and finally, you know, it bothered him for a long time. You know, guys he raced with, people he knew who worked on his cars back in the Northeast or back in Florida, you know, that didn't really want anything to do with him anymore. But he finally accepted in his own mind that, look, you know, I'm not going to say I'm sorry. I did what I did. I got caught. Ultimately, he lost a total of 10 years of his life, you know, behind bars. So, as he puts it, I've paid my dues. I'm not going to say that what I did wasn't wrong, but I'm not going to apologize to you and you and you. You know, this is what I did, and it happened. And, you know, again, it goes right back to who Gary was anyway. He was always one of the most interesting guys at the racetrack. He's led an incredible life, both good and bad. And it's, you know, I'm sure he has regrets, but like he put it and still puts it, he's past the point where he's going to keep apologizing for it.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more Running Smoke. Running Smoke is a production of Campside Media, Dan Patrick Productions, and Workhouse Media. Written and reported by me, Rajiv Gola. Our producers are Aaliyah Papes, Lane Gerbig, and Julie Denishay. Our editors are Michelle Lanz and Emily Martinez. Sound design and original music by Mark McAdam. Additional sound and mixing by Ewan Lai Tremuin. Additional reporting by Susie McCarthy. Our executive producers are Dan Patrick, Josh Dean of Campside Media, Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood for Workhouse Media. Fact-checking by Mary Mathis and Angeli Mercado. Artwork by Polly Adams. And additional thanks to Greg Horn, Johnny Kaufman, Sierra Franco, Elizabeth Van Brocklin, and Sean Flynn.
At At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.